Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and I'm now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Sudeep Lad for a conversation on investing in education. We'll break down the various investable segments within education, exploring both their attractive attributes and their key risks, and we'll discuss the sector's social impact. Sudeep is a partner at LEK Consulting and a member of their global education practice. Prior to joining LEK, Sudeep was in the education practice of EY Parthenon. Sudeep has lots of experience working with education groups and with investors in education, including private equity firms, development finance institutions, and family offices. Over his career, he has worked on over 400 projects in education, covering more than 40 geographies. He holds a Bachelor of Technology from the IIT Bombay and an MBA from the Indian School of Business. Sudeep, it's great to have you here today. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Monde. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you. Well, first off, before we get to investing in education, we'd first love to learn a bit more about you, your path, your journey. So tell us a bit about where you grew up, a little bit about your family, and ultimately, what was your path into education?
Sure. I think recalling back, I grew up in a tier two city in India, did my schooling pretty much there. I think all of us probably, Monday, grew up in an era where in most parts, education was probably the only way and a very common way for upward mobility for most of, you know, emerging Asia and probably India as well. So I think that drive took me to one of the most prestigious institutions in the country. So I did my engineering from IIT Bombay. A few years in, you know, post IIT Bombay, I spent a few years into management consulting, looking at various businesses, and then I got into a B school. So I started in consulting post B school as an entry level consultant and have had a sort of a rewarding journey so far with the sector. And it's quite exciting how things are changing within education, though the core of it probably remains the same.
That's very interesting. Thanks, Sudeep. Maybe just staying a little bit on your upbringing. So you mentioned a tier two city in India. India is a huge country, very diverse. So maybe if you could just name the city for us, I'd appreciate that. And then the other, I'd love to hear a bit more about your path into IIT Bombay. For those in our audience who aren't aware, these schools are extraordinarily selective. And so I'd love to hear a bit about how competitive it was and how many applications do they get versus the number of students.
So I grew up in a city called Indore, and it's probably, you know, heartland when you look at India, a city in central India. It's developed a lot from then, now probably an education hub in the country. But yeah, I think it was a fierce competition. So, you know, the selectivity or the selection rate, Monday, is closer to probably 0.1 or 0.01%. There are at that time about 5 or 6 IITs, and there are sort of, you know, many candidates applying for the same. Pretty much everybody who is clearing high school and getting into science as a work stream would aspire for it. So there was a great deal of preparation. I mean, test prep is one of the largest, big industries in India. So huge coaching institutes and parents going beyond their capability to fund their test prep. So I was lucky enough to go through that grind and come out with flying colors, humbly enough.
That's wonderful, Sudeep, and great to hear. I think one of the things that stands out for me about India is the sheer scale of the place. So you've got, I think it's 350 million school children. And as you say, the acceptance rates then in these five or six IITs being the most prestigious institutions in the country, you've got all of those students, you know, fighting for these few places. So congratulations on that. And it's wonderful to hear a bit about that journey as well. And maybe a little bit about your family. Do you have siblings or were you an only child, and your parents as well?
Yeah. So I have an elder sister and you know, we're pretty much, you know, the same age group, you know, 2 years gap. And, I still am married. I have a son. I still live with my parents. So,
okay. So that's interesting. So is that multiple generations in the same house? Is that what I was hearing, right? You've got your parents and you and your children. So three generations.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is also pretty much sort of, you know, a bit more typical for India than in other countries.
Okay. All right. I hope both my in-laws and my parents don't listen to this episode and start getting any ideas. okay. Let's move on then to some of the main topics for discussion. And I appreciate you telling us a bit about your family and your upbringing. So investing in education. You've done a lot of projects. I mentioned up front over 400 projects in education, over 40 geographies. So you've seen a lot of this sector. So in the time that you've been consulting in education, have the levels of investment activity grown? Have they stayed flat or have they reduced?
So as per the estimate that I recall, if you look at, you know, in the last year completed, the value of, disclosed transactions in education investments has reached closer to $20 to $25 billion. And this number about 7-8 years back in 2015, was closer to $10 to $12 billion. So what we are seeing is that there's a rapid growth, and investments have pretty much doubled in the last 7 to 8 years. Education and why this happens? I mean, education is one of the top 10 sectors for global economy. But compared to its size, the number of large companies in the sector are still relatively small. And to that extent, I mean, education has remained a very cottage industry, mostly owing to the nature of the sector, which is that it is very local, but also it is reflection of the maturity of the sector. Okay.
Maybe just to pause there, Sudeep, just a clarification as you go along, so you don't lose me there. The size of $20 to $25 billion, just to be clear, is that the investment each year that is made?
Absolutely. That's the investment that is made each year into education. And this is only the disclosed ones, which means I'm sure there's a top up to this, which is, you know, not reported in various agencies that track it.
Understood. And if it's investment then, so this would only be the independent or the private education sector. It would obviously exclude everything that's done in the public sector, which would obviously be far, far larger than that. Okay. All right. So there's about $20 to $25 billion in investments being made each year by investors into education groups. And that's roughly doubled since 2015. Okay. Let me follow you in that path then. So you were saying historically it was a fairly localized industry and there weren't that many big groups, but it sounds like that has changed over the last decade.
But commercially, it demonstrates all the right characteristics. So you have very strong resilience. Parents and students will continue to come to high quality products, irrespective of what happens to economy as a whole. Long term revenue visibility in the sector, which is very strong. Negative working capital, very high barriers to entry. So I think all of these things have meant that as a business model, it is attractive for investors. And as you note, there is an opportunity that global consolidators have seen a sector which traditionally is very mom and pop. One or two passionate educators have opened up a school or an institution or a college, but they have not focused a lot more on, you know, the systematic commercial aspects of things. So global consolidators have eyed this, have viewed this as an opportunity, and they have acted upon it. And, you know, in a way they have sort of, you know, done good by doing well themselves.
And is this across various segments of education that these consolidators have come in, or has it been more concentrated in a specific sector of or section of education?
No, I think broadly the story of platforms, right, is more prevalent in K through 12 education. Over the last decade, we have seen, you know, Nord Anglia, which is the largest global K 12 platform, has reached closer to $2 billion revenue in terms of, you know, annual tuition revenue over or sort of, you know, ownership of close to 90 plus schools. So I think K 12 is ahead. There's a journey that higher education has also taken, but we believe that there's more to happen in higher education. Early years has seen consolidation. I think there the unit of complexity is even smaller, so it tends to be a bit more difficult. But K-12 and higher ed are the two segments, Monday, which tend to be very, you know, non-discretionary from a spend point of view, and as a result they scale, and as a result they attract attention from investors.
Understood. So if I come back then, you know, the market was $12 billion going in investment into independent education groups each year, 2015. Now a decade later, it's $20 to $25 billion going in each year. If you look forward, what do you think the outlook looks like in whichever time period you pick?
Yeah, I think overall the outlook is quite positive, because even if all the consolidation that we've talked about, I think amongst the top five or seven platforms that we're talking about, Nord Anglia, Cognita, Inspired, ISP, GEMS, and others, we are probably talking about, you know, close to 20-25% of markets, that too in key cities. So there is more to be done, from the point of view of consolidation, number one. And I think, these platforms have largely gone to the mid-market or premium end of the segment. If you go one level below in price curve, what you note is the level of fragmentation is even larger. So you have, you know, another set of regional or, you know, country level platforms which are coming up. They are coming off age, and now they are attracting, you know, attention of investors. So that's the K-12 story. But then there are other sectors like higher ed. And we believe that I think the next decade would belong to higher education in a similar way as, you know, the past decade was in large parts activity on the K-12 side of things.
Okay, got it. So positive prospects for the next decade as well. Just to understand a few points that you mentioned there. So you mentioned these big, you use the word aggregators or consolidators. I think you use both of those terms, Nord Anglia, ISP, et cetera, in the K-12 space. And these are large commercial enterprises, $1 billion plus revenue, 70, 80,000, you know, even more than 100,000 sometimes students that they serve across multiple countries. And you said that they hold 20 to 25% market share. So just for me to understand, is that of the independent education markets in those cities, or are you including the government as well when you say 20 to 25% market share?
Only the independent, or, you know, in emerging markets, it's called private education. So this is private, that to above a certain price point, assuming that, you know, these platforms have today not gone below a certain threshold of price point.
Okay, got it. So you've still then got quite a fragmented market. So even all these large players are only 20 to 25% of the market. So the market remains fragmented, so they can continue consolidating. And then some of these other smaller players, the other 75 or 80%, it sounds like, are also growing in and of themselves and becoming substantial commercial entities.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the other measures we look at, Monday, in terms of, you know, the headroom for growth in the segment, if you look at affordability level, you know, adjusted adoption levels in mid-price, premium schools, bilingual schools, they are nowhere close to saturation. So meaning that families that can afford, probably 20-30%, depending on which markets we're talking about, mostly in emerging markets, are actually consuming a product of that kind. So that's another metric that suggests that there's more that can happen in emerging markets, particularly on this side of things.
Okay, thanks, Sudeep. And let's maybe move on and try break down education into a few of its segments. So how do you define the investable segments within this market?
Yeah, I think the simplest way we look at the simplest lens with which we look at the market is the age group. So basically, it's a sector which goes from, pre-K to gray, as some people call it. If you then, start going in that age, spectrum, you have early years. In early years, there's a huge, sort of, gap in terms of access of early years provision. And it is a segment where, there's a lot of informal, usage. Families are now turning, nuclear. So there's an element of access in that space, although the unit of complexity is small.
Sudeep, sorry, again, just to clarify there. So early years there, we're talking children in the ages of, below 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah,
So
basically
what,
three, two to five,
okay. So in some countries, it'll be called a preschool, ECD,
Preschool,
lots of
early
different
years.
names. Okay.
Yeah,
All right.
absolutely.
Understood. Yep.
So that is one segment. I think huge demand, but not an easy business model, just because you have to set up units which are in your micro catchments. Parents are not willing to send children to a center which is more than, let's say 10, 15, 20 minutes away from the home. So as a result, the unit of complexity becomes that center, and you need to have many centers in order to reach a similar level of financial outcome. And that takes you to K-12. I think we've talked a lot about K-12 in our points that we spoke about one day. That's where the catchment becomes bigger. So you're talking about subsidy level catchments. In some cases, when schools are very reputed, the catchment could also be quite beyond the city. So K-12 is what investors like. The customer lifetime value is close to 5, 8, 12 years, depending on what you're offering. And I mean, interestingly, in K-12, you have to demonstrate outcomes, but outcomes do come right at the top. So if you're a school which has outcomes over the years, that acts as a very strong sort of, indicator of quality. Higher education, investors like this sector because the actually you're dealing with learners of a higher age group. So the sort of, the sensitivities are less. The single site scalability in higher education is actually significantly higher than what you see in K-12. So universities can have at one campus 10, 20, 30,000 students. And they, with the scale, they're talking about 40% plus type of EBITDA margins. So in fact, the largest scale company in education that has ever existed, Monday, is a higher education company called Laureate, which at its peak is closer to $5 billion, top line, with a network of closer to 90 plus universities across the globe. So higher education scales profitable. Then you have a host of after school tutoring, enrichment, which are not necessarily your school, mainstream school or sort of mainstream higher education institution, but they are test prep institutions, they are English language learning institutions, they are after school tutoring institutions. So very center-based model. I think this segment got hit the most from COVID, in addition to pre-K. And then you have EdTech, which is probably, cutting across. Which has lost a little bit of a flavor or, and we are living in times where the EdTech frenzy that the world saw over 20 to 22 period is sort of, settling down, and we can talk more about it.
Okay, there's a lot there, a lot there to go through, Sudeep. So if I just take the segments that you've broken it down into and they go by age range, the first in the early years, each center there is very small. So maybe 50 children, 100 children, or smaller than that. And it's also quite a sensitive sector. So while there has been investment in there, you've done less work in that space or you've seen less investor activity in that space. But there are some scaled platform there. There is private equity capital there. I can think of, for instance, Endeavor Schools in the US or Cadence Education. I think we've seen as some of the consolidators that are there that would be at least worth in the hundreds of millions of dollars would be my expectation.
Absolutely. And just to add on childcare, it is also supported by subsidies. So there's a there's a very strong sort of, you know, policy imperative to sustain a labor force, workforce participation by families, you know, by women. And as a result, in Europe, in Australia, in UK, you have subsidies. And given some of these subsidies, pre-K has become an interesting sector for infrastructure funds. So you have Antin IP, which has invested in a large platform in Europe called Bevelu. And then in Australia, you have Guardian, Affinity are sort of, you know, 100 million plus minus Australian dollar EBITDA type of platforms on the back of, you know, policy supported regime.
Understood. And that echoes with my experience as well. The scaled platforms I've seen in that early years phase have tended to be in developed markets rather than in developing markets, where, as you say, access is still a big problem. Most children of that age in our countries are actually getting the formal education that they need. Okay. And then the sort of early years, and then you went through K-12 and discussed that in depth. And obviously now the schools are larger, several thousand students. So that appeals a lot more to the investor base. And also they're staying for 12 years, which appeals a lot, that recurring revenue and visibility. And then you mentioned higher ed, where now it's thousands per site, but they are staying shorter. So there is some risk in that. This is now 4 years or 3 years that your student or client stays with you rather than 12. But they have been groups of scale, and there are groups of scale in the billions of dollars there. And then the other is the after school tutoring and the ed tech. That's a lot that you went through there. So maybe rather than going through the detail in each and every one of those categories, let's just talk through some of the themes that you are particularly excited about if you look forward over the next decade. It could be in one of these categories and how it overlays with, for instance, geography. What are some of the areas within this whole industry that you're excited about?
Yeah, I think if we take the same sort of, you know, lens, K-12 continues to be exciting. What we are seeing a lot these days is that, you know, there is opportunity at the premium end, and at the premium end, what's happening is British independent brands, you know, the likes of Wellington, Arrow, Dulwich, and others, they are increasingly expanding to emerging markets. And, you know, about 5 years back, a lot of traffic from that intention was to China. But given the regulatory landscape in China, that has now shifted to, you know, the broader Asia. So that is a theme that we are seeing within K-12. While, you know, the premium end is being served by these global platforms, I think there's
Could I double click on that, Sudeep, before we come to the second thing you're excited about? Just on that first you're excited about, this is one of the points I found really interesting as well. You've got multiple Harrow schools in Asia, which I think, I suspect the average person in education would, or outside of education rather, would not know. You would think of Harrow, you think of, you know, one school in the UK, or you think of Repton or North Collegiate London, the girls' school, or Dulwich, you know, all these ones that you mentioned. How is this actually happening? They've got, these schools have extraordinary history. They're 500, 600, 700 years old. A lot of them are non-profits, but yet they're expanding into other countries. How is that actually working?
They have, you know, partners in various countries or in the region, and they work with, either they can have, you know, partnerships with organizations. For example, Harrow works very you know, closely with a Hong Kong based group called Asia International Schools Limited, AISL, which has the rights to sort of open Harrow schools within Asia. And then you know, either it could be a regional level partnerships, country level partnerships. Some school brands have decided to go with different partners in different countries. So you know, in most situations, these would be, let's say, you know, real estate conglomerates or diversified business groups who will be responsible to get these brands to the home markets. Typically, there's a sort of, you know, revenue share and royalty type of arrangement, commercial arrangement between the two parties. But most of the sort of, you know, business responsibility, operating responsibility lies with the local partner. And brands then give their own sort of, you know, curriculum training to teachers and quality assurance as one of the you know, things that they give in return to the royalties that they claim from the local groups.
That's very fascinating. And I think it really is an interesting development over the last decade or two in the education sector. It's akin really to franchising, which you see in many other industries. While it's not called that in education, it really is very, very similar to that. And what I do find interesting, some of the examples you mentioned. So you mentioned Asia International Schools Limited, which runs the Harrow Schools in Asia. And I do find it interesting, you know, we look at other partnerships as well, where the international expansion is done in a commercial or for-profit model, whereas the home market, the home school, is in a non-profit model. But there's a win-win there, because the provider in an emerging market gets instant brand recognition from a 700-year-old brand. They get help with hiring the right teachers, with having the right curriculum, all these things. And at the home market back in the UK, where the struggles of the independent education sector, they are well written about, with the change in taxes recently, et cetera. But they get to future-proof themselves by providing additional income sources. So it does seem to me from the outside to be a win-win and a really fascinating development in education. Well, that was an interesting theme that you're excited about. I had stopped you. You were about to go into your second, but I was interested to dive deeper in that.
And just to continue on the K-12, while the premium end is exciting, there are platforms being built at the mid-market, lower end of the curve as well. Because as I mentioned, that is where the level of fragmentation is more, and also the mass market, the addressable market, is significantly more. There are in many markets, the demand supply situation is quite favorable, but because of lack of options, many parents end up, choosing suboptimal options. So there's a lot more to consolidate there in terms of quality, professionalization, and so on and so forth. We are seeing emergence of those type of platforms in Asia, in Africa, and which are now seeking investor interest. So that's on K-12. I think on the higher education side, clearly the way we measure the opportunity is that most of the emerging markets, the gross enrollment ratios are sub 20-30%. Sorry, whole of Africa actually is at a gross enrollment ratio of 13%. What that means is about 13% of population in the relevant age group, which is, let's say, 18 to 24, is in some form of higher education. So, and that number is 13% for Africa. It has a potential to grow in line with the economic growth, because there's a very strong correlation between economic growth and education attainment, which for Africa is very low. So I think there is, and public universities, governments are not adding capacity. Even if they are, they are leading to overcrowding of classrooms. So I think there's a role that private sector is playing. If you pick Africa example, Honoris is a consolidator. They have acquired institutions and professionalized them across South Africa, North Africa, and they've grown to a scale of close to 200 million plus top line. So I think we are excited about just the classic brick and mortar higher education and a roll up or a platform play within higher ed.
Those are all really interesting. The three you've named so far, the premium K-12 or school segment, many of them in partnership with UK brands, but going to emerging markets. The second, the mid-market or mid-fee offering, where they're trying to offer high quality academic outcomes, but at materially lower price points. And that being a big theme in markets like here, like in Africa and parts of Asia, et cetera. One of the ones just to add there that I'm interested in within that mid-fee level is the countries where people want to learn English. So if you think of countries like Vietnam, et cetera, that mid-fee private school model seems really, really interesting. You've got a big segment of the population that wants their kids to learn English, and they're finding that in these independent schools. And the third, higher education in Africa. So 13% gross enrollment ratio is a bit of a travesty, to be honest. The rest of the world has left my home continent here, Africa, behind by quite a long distance. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in bringing investment into higher education in order to create more seats. There was recently in South Africa, we've just come out of the enrollment cycle. I won't remember the exact numbers, but around 200,000 to 300,000 applicants, or students applied for around 10,000 places at a university here in South Africa. I think it was the University of Johannesburg that published those stats. So, you know, 20, 30 times the demand relative to the number of seats. Now, some of that, of course, will be a student applies to multiple universities. So some of it is captured there. But having a 20 to 30x, you know, the demand or applications can't all be attributed to that. So there's a huge job, and it's a sector that I'm excited about as well. So are there any others that you want to talk through, or should I move into some of the risks as well?
So I think in the higher education opportunity that I mentioned holds true not just for Africa, but also, you know, various parts, let's say in, you know, Asia, in some cases in Latin America. So that's an emerging market theme. If you move further, I think one of the themes that is quite prevalent and has been quite prevalent over the last decade is about global mobility and international student mobility, which is, you know, so there are about 7 million students enrolled in higher education in a situation that they are studying abroad outside of their home country for higher education. About 40-45% of this is this volume is to Anglophone markets. So Australia, US, Canada, and UK. So I think there's a very strong demand in higher education also of foreign programs, foreign degrees. But we are living in that unique point in the history, Monde, where all these Anglophone markets are having, you know, unfavorable policy regime, be it visa restrictions, dependent spouse restrictions, or just sheer sort of, you know, clamping down on agents who move students from one, you know, source country to abroad. So I think while demand is there, the supply from a regulatory side is a bit constrained. I think that's where there's an opportunity, and the landscape is shifting towards regional mobility. And what I mean by regional mobility is, let's say, you know, students from China or Asia, they used to go to the US. That flow is still there, by the way, in large parts. But they are increasingly looking for options closer, let's say in Singapore, in Malaysia, in Thailand. And interestingly, there are foreign degree programs being offered in Singapore, Malaysia, which offer home country degrees, like parent campus degrees, and at a, you know, obviously lower cost than what they would have to incur at the home market. So that's a theme, and within that, before I let you comment for reflections, is universities like foreign British brands in K-12 are entering Asia. Universities are also increasingly looking at that opportunity. So RMIT, for example, Monash, for example, Australian universities have set up campuses, foreign branch in Vietnam, in Indonesia. University of Southampton about to open a campus in India. So that this whole trend of, you know, demand for foreign education, but being served more locally in higher ed, is also a thesis which is panning out, and we'll see quite a few developments over the next 5 to 10 years.
That's very interesting, Sudeep. I've spent a fair amount of time looking at that, the sort of franchise models in schools. I haven't looked as much in higher ed, so thanks for that. That'll be some of my reading after this. And if we come, then you've spoken a lot about the investment case and what's attractive and increased levels of investment in the sector. If you were speaking to someone who is either new to investing in the sector or just some anecdotes from some of the landmines that you've seen, and every industry has landmines that people can step on. So what are some of the risks to investing in this sector that investors should avoid?
I think policy intervention is something that investors need to consider carefully. Now, not every market could be, you know, stroke of a pen rest like what happened in China, but regulations are uncertain. So I think that is something that I would highlight as one of the areas which need to be considered. Now, in most parts, education is for profit, and it's allowed, it's viewed as a complementary solution. But in some markets, it is not meant to be a for profit industry. I think in education, you could very easily get affected by reputational risks, particularly when you're running chains or franchisees. These can become large systems, right? And not everything is controllable. And if one thing goes wrong in one nook and corner of your, you know, operations, it could leave the platform, with that reputational, a risk or a danger. So I think those are the two. Within regulation, some markets, which investors don't like, the price or the fee growth is also controlled. And I think that keeps the overall appetite for margins in control. But that could break investment cases for some investors as they look at it. So yeah, I think those would be some, but these days a lot is being talked about technology disruption. We have lived, two or three generations of discussions around tech disruption. I think K-12 and higher ed tend to be very non-discretionary, very brick and mortar heavy, and they have demonstrated so. So tech will probably continue to be an enabler. And businesses that embrace technology or AI as enabler are likely to have an upper hand in terms of growth, market share, and other elements.
That's very interesting, Sudeep. And there's actually a lot of depth in each of the points that you mentioned there. Maybe one that I'll just click on or double click on is this point around technology that you mentioned at the end, and it being an enabler rather than, replacing. It definitely has a role in expanding access, particularly in higher education where, it's older students. I think it is a little bit easier to have technology there. But I cannot see version of the future, the next few decades at least, where teachers are still not absolutely critical, where FaceTime with other children is critical to learning and development and all the other things. It's not only maths that you're learning in school. It's how to interact with people, how to deal with people, all that kind of stuff. But it's very exciting what technology can do as an enabler to effective teaching and learning. So maybe let's go there a little bit. How have you seen technology affecting the sector? And if there are any ways that it's being innovatively used to deliver quality education at a low price?
We're seeing various models and many of the features that are coming, they are sort of, work in progress, but a lot is being talked about, apps which are helping teachers in lesson plan. There are tools which are enabling adaptive learning. There are chatbots for, doubt resolution. So I think a lot of innovation is happening in multiple directions. Generally, what we've seen is that adoption or the risk of disruption is significantly higher in enrichment related businesses. And we've already seen, tutoring, English language training have seen greater adoption of technology because the likes of Duolingo can teach languages on your app, and so that works well at the adult language learning, not so much at kids level, but still there's disruption. So sector wise it affects that sector more, which is more around enrichment, after school tutoring. I think the way, and we wouldn't call that there is a business today which is North Star in deploying technology. But look, while pure play niches, pure play online elements work only in niches, the brick and mortar businesses or businesses, who are mainstream businesses, but want to leverage technology have thought about it in three ways. Number one, How can technology help enhance my top line? And top line can be achieved by, can I launch newer products to get to newer customer segments, which I'm not today serving. You made the point on access, which technology can create. So that goes there. So for example, I'm today serving traditional high school level students in higher education, but can I serve working adults by offering an online program, which is equivalent of what is being done for traditional high school leavers? So revenue, looking at top line. The second is, efficiency, operational efficiency, cost. In some cases, you can unlock teacher time quite significantly through the use of technology. And all the admin tasks can be done by technology, while teachers can focus on what they love, which is spending time with learners. And I think third is about personalization, or and which goes also hand in hand with standardization of quality, but to the extent that it can be personalized to the learner. So I think those are the three main broad bucket elements where technology is making impact. The sector is still sort of new to adopt technology in most parts, but we will see a lot more as we enter into the next leg of this technology revolution in education.
And maybe then the other side of that coin. So that's technology that we're discussing there. Do you think that by and large, K-12 is going to remain brick and mortar, and so will parts of higher education and in person. So that the other side of that coin then is the infrastructure or the real estate. I think it's well known to our audience that the two main uses of cash in a school are salaries on the one hand, which is mainly to your teachers, and then your infrastructure on the other hand, which is the real estate. And it can cost, 10, 20, $30 million to build a school, depending on the country and the city it's in, and the nature of the school, etc. So big capital investment up front. Have you seen what are your views on the asset light versus asset heavy model, and have you seen any trends on that side?
Yeah, very strong preference these days for asset light models. Traditionally, education is a sector which is which was linked closely with, if you have space, you open school. If you have space, you're owning real estate, you open a higher education sort of institution. But the sector is moving away from that. We are seeing that the models of PropCo and OpCo are emerging, which means that the real estate and the property affairs are being handled by separate organization, while the core education operations are handled by a different party. Interestingly, just to move a step further to that, is there are specialist funds who are taking investment bets in PropCos, where for them the return expectations are at the yield levels of the PropCo, while separate investors are investing in the operating part of education, which is what we talked about all the while. So I think as the sector matures, you will see these type of unbundling, and it will unlock a lot of value, because investors who want, who are good at and who want to take a bet on real estate property part of things could continue doing that, while operators create more access and generate quality which goes beyond what exists. So we are seeing that. In fact, there are funds which are sort of dedicating capital to backing PropCo level investments in K-12 and in tertiary education.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Sudeep. Thanks. And maybe then coming to my final question on investing in education before I come back to you. Tell me a little bit about how you think of the social impact of the private or independent education sector.
Yeah, I think the social aspect, private education comes at various price points. So, not talking market specific, but a private school fee could go from, as low as $200 a year, all the way up to $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year from an annual tuition. So I think what private sector has done in regions or in countries where it has a high share is that it has given choice for families to consume education at a price point that at which they can afford. Now, a private education has also become a complementary solution to public education, in the sense that public education cannot expand beyond its limit. There are constraints on public budgets. So in that sense, it is creating access. Private education is creating access. Private education is creating choices. It is viewed as a complementary solution. I think many social or infra funds have taken that view, And the fact that, there are high barriers to entry for good quality products. Education also acts as, essential service. So, it is also, as you move to higher ed, it's creating employment outcomes, which is, entry into a workforce, which facilitates upward mobility. It also facilitates global mobility of talent. So that's the social element that private education has created.
That's great, Sudeep. Yeah, it's very real. Where I'm, my home country, South Africa, the gap in spend, there's no ways that the public sector can fill that gap by itself. The World Bank and the Development Bank of Southern Africa did a study a couple of years ago, and they estimated that until 2030, South Africa would need to spend an additional about 2 trillion rand only on its education infrastructure. So just upgrading existing facilities and building new facilities to get them up to standard. And, that's 5.5% of GDP per annum every year between now and 2030, which, there's no realistic way that the government can dedicate that much money just purely towards education infrastructure. So you've got to get private capital involved. And it's very hard to get private capital involved if there isn't a reasonable commercial model. So, it can't be egregious returns. It can't be a 60% return, but reasonably above cost of capital, a 20-25% return is the kind of thing that the private sector would put capital towards. And ultimately, when you say, institutional capital or private sector, we're talking about our pensions. That's the stuff that all of us will retire on. So now this that you're talking about now is very real here in our home country of South Africa and in many other developing countries as well. So Sudeep, I've really appreciated the conversation on investing in education and talking about the various categories within it. So if I come back then to you now at the end, I ask the same concluding question to all of my guests, and that is, please tell me about your favorite teacher or educator.
Obviously, parents are your biggest educator at one time in your sort of journey. But at the same time, now that sort of I'm a parent myself, children can teach you in many ways. So, I recall a teacher in my secondary sort of school where sort of, the idea was to care less about technicalities of the subject, but go beyond and, create a, a strong personality, individuality, element of citizenship beyond just the technicality of the course. So I think that stood out. And I think in the higher education days, I got exposed to open book exams for the first time, when I entered my sort of, undergrad. And I think it's been time, but look, it leaves a good sort of memory that, and which is actually getting amplified now, that we are, when world is becoming a place where knowledge is out there, right? It's just that you need to learn how to learn, number one, and then, need to know what is where and how to probably apply it. So we are sort of, we are in that mode with that, all the technology that exists, the knowledge is available, quite easily, but learning is more about how to consume that knowledge. And, learning itself is about sort of, how to learn.
That's excellent, Sudeep. Thank you very much for sharing that, and more broadly for giving us a good overview of the education investment landscape and the various segments within it. I really appreciate your time today.
Super. Thanks for having me. It was a great discussion, and obviously we covered a few topics, but we could probably go into, depth of each of them Monday, but you and I would be sitting here for hours if we do that.
Thank you for listening. We really value your support. This episode was brought to you by Education Partners, a leading investor in school and tertiary campus properties, and a trusted long-term partner to exceptional education groups. For more information, visit www.edu.partners. That's edu.partners.